Committee, the Senate Special Committee on Healthcare Reform, call it to order. Today is Wednesday, April 25th, and we will have a short public hearing. We have one witness signed up to testify, a short public hearing on 329, so I'll open up a public hearing and call Mr. Gallant to the phones.
The phone.
Hello? Any time of day.
I like it when it's at my convenience, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. We are here to serve.
You don't know who you are.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm the Associate Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Association. Appreciate the opportunity to make a few brief comments regarding Senate Bill 329. The last version I saw was dash 5. I just started to quickly go through the dash 6 amendments. Since they don't indicate what changes have been made, it's difficult to comment on what those specifics may be. But from a quick look, they appear to be relatively similar. I have testified before the committee earlier last month and made some observations then, and we had, an interesting conversation in part. Your legislation actually has, in some degree, from your interim work, really changed, and it's become a number of things, in my view, and the association's view, beyond essentially the development of a process to actually take a variety of options that might enable the state to get to universal coverage in Oregon. It essentially has become a process of establishing a permanent board, potentially a trust fund that would collect resources from the public and private sector. It presumes assumptions about a design of a health reform package that varies from potential rate setting to limitations on reimbursement to the Portland Salem CPI. It also creates a structure for reviewing every state agency and every program that has to do with health care under the assumption that you would consolidate those programs. From the reading of the bill, it's hard to tell where it might go, but one has to presume that it would go under the Oregon Health Trust Fund. That is a huge project, on its own is exceedingly complex and will be exceedingly expensive to do. And I'm sure the committee has considered the budgetary implications of that. And then the bill essentially does also say that there will be a proposal for comprehensive health care reform that will eventually be recommended to the legislature. And there are other portions or particulars of the bill that I refer to as well. The association, as you know, has long supported universal coverage. We continue to do so. We presented you with a variety of our principles for health care reform. And essentially, it's that we should use the best of the private sector and the best of the public sector and figure out a clear and concise way to finance fairly the cost of providing universal coverage. I'm not sure that as the bill is currently written that we necessarily get there. I think there is still substantial work to be done. There are some peculiarities in the bill that I think I'm compelled to mention. For example, this legislation proposes that the board, the trust fund board, is exempt from the public contracting laws. And I find that rather peculiar, but I'm sure there's a logical explanation for that. But essentially that would mean that you would not have, the board would not have to have competitive bids for services that it would contract for. And if one were a cynic, which some have accused me of, that might imply that the board would be able to select an accountable health plan to provide the services for which the board ultimately would be responsible for. But I could be reading that wrong. Secondly, the bill says, even though it may only be for the purpose of collecting private employer and individual premiums and other premiums, that all those premiums would be collected by the board and then redistributed. I can't quite surmise what the benefit of that is unless there is some ability or the desires to have some ability to divert private premium resources into some other mechanism to help provide coverage for the uninsured. But the bill doesn't really explain that as it's currently drafted. As you know, there have been some analyses, for example, of what it would cost to cover over a biennium Oregonians with 200% or less of the federal poverty level. I believe that estimate is $3.5 billion. And I don't believe that it would actually reach all of the those who are uninsured in the state of Oregon. My point is that we are talking serious money. And what it ultimately means, we're talking about having to find some kind of serious mechanism for funding health insurance premiums in order to attain universal coverage. There really isn't a very extensive delineation or discussion about the alternatives that might be possible in order to fund universal coverage in this state and how it would actually operate. I do want to say that I appreciate that the committee has decided to investigate some of the federal laws that provide barriers to the state of Oregon on being able to provide better insurance coverage in Oregon. I think there are limitations to what... Oh, thank you. Couldn't have anything to do with smoking cigarettes.
And what organization do you represent?
That's in Section 6. Personal responsibility.
I think you would like my level of health care utilization. Thank you very much.
After this
probably
point.
Better than some, I know. Nevertheless, let's take EMTALA, for example, at least the Dash 5 EMTALA, which is the federal law that requires facilities to accept any patient who believes they have an emergency and treat them. The reason that law was put into books, rightfully or wrongfully, was that many years ago, people, sometimes pregnant women, I'm sure in other parts of the country, would show up at hospitals ready to deliver, and they were turned away. And so there was a reason for having that statute on the books. But my point is that the original Dash 5 amendments talked about requesting or exploring the possibility of a waiver of EMTALA. You'll never get a waiver for EMTALA. It's law. And whether it was a drafting error or otherwise, if you want to address that issue, then you would have to request federal legislation to make an exception to the Intella statute, just as a practical matter. Our bottom line is the critical part to legislation that this legislature might consider, in our view, is a process that is adequately funded, that clearly delineates the options and implications of any reform package for employers, for patients, for the healthcare system, so that we all know, in one parlance, what we're buying, what it will cost, and what benefit all of us will gain from comprehensive universal access to health care coverage. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Scott. You brought up a long litany of issues, and just to touch on a couple of them, and I'll see then if the committee has any questions. But and far be it from me to say that someone who has probably worked harder in this building over the last 72 or 100 hours, who happens to be sitting in the audience, made a drafting error. All I will say to that is that the dash sixes do not request a waiver, but they do instruct the delegation to hold congressional hearings to perhaps pass legislation. One of your more fundamental points was the cost of insuring the uninsured population, and that is certainly a significant expense under the best of circumstances, which we currently don't enjoy. But to put that in perspective, I mean, what this state spent on health care in 2005, you know, is a staggering $19 billion. So while insuring the uninsured is not only what I think is a moral imperative, it also makes economic sense, so those folks, as you well understand, aren't accessing the system late in their disease, not necessarily late in their life, late in their disease, incurring exponentially larger cost and producing poorer outcomes. But as always, I appreciate you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that there was a question there, but I'll make an observation. Under the Medicare program now, system costs or plan costs now exceed the expenditures for those who actually provide services to patients. Now below hospitals, always have been. I believe drug costs are possibly over that as well. The fact of the matter is there are a variety of policies, and I'll give you a simple example, that are probably good policies for meeting a societal obligation that are put in place but typically are not paid for. Interpretive services, that was a requirement adopted by the Office of Civil Rights and imposed on every state and every physician in both public and private programs. On average, it costs more, which physicians have to pay out of their pocket, not necessarily for Medicaid because there's some consideration there. Interpreters are paid more per visit than the physician is paid when they see the patient. Now, I think it's a wonderful policy and it's appropriate, but I have seen, and you have seen many a time, when policies are put in place that are not funded. And it happens time and time again. Now, I appreciate, for example, the desire to only increase costs by the CPI, Consumer Price Index, but there is a Medicare economic index that most certainly reflects what it costs in health care to provide services that policymakers like you ask physicians to provide. And I gave you an illustration of that in my testimony. Medicaid is the same. And their results for setting good policy and not meeting the obligation to pay for the decisions that we all make. And what are those implications? Well, the implications are we have more and more physicians who either do not or limit the number of Medicare and Medicaid patients that they see. Is it because they don't want to necessarily? No. It has to do with their ability to remain in practice. Their margins are 2-3% on average. I don't think that's out of the realm of reasonableness. Overhead costs are typically 50-60%. Physicians spend anywhere from 20-30% of their time on administrative paperwork, on making sure that they send information so that they can be tracked on how they deal with patients. Or let's take another important issue that everyone really wants to accomplish. Electronic medical records. The average cost per physician for electronic medical records is $44,000. Not counting annual costs of maintaining it, assuming that you actually have the personnel who can do it in rural areas, it is $10,000 per physician per year. And we're more than supportive that we go to an interoperable electronic medical record system. It isn't going to do all the things that people think it's going to do, but there are cost implications with it. And one would think any reasonable business person, and by the way, I don't know of any electronic system that has been cost neutral or has had a rate of return on investment in any short-term period that I've seen or studied. One would think that the right thing to do is, if that's your policy, then let's set up a mechanism to help people pay for it and be upfront about it.
Mr. Chair.
I just want to say I take some exception to that last comment. I don't think anyone is dismissing the severity of the funding challenges, least of all this committee. We have worked very diligently to address as many concerns as we can and set up a process that will honestly, legitimately, and forthrightly address the substantial challenge of properly and fairly funding this system.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think your testimony confirms in my mind, Scott, the need for what we're doing. The 5 or 10 minutes you just talked about, the complexity of the issues we have to deal with, the difficulty of those issues, the fact they're not being dealt with, leads me to believe that we're on the right path here. We need a board and we need committees of experts to sit down and solve these thousands of problems we've got in healthcare delivery. I think your testimony leads me right back to where this bill is. There may be flaws in this bill. There may be things some people like and some people don't like. We've tried to make it something that is workable for all. We want a board and an organization that has some direction where to go, but not to be so prescriptive that we've tied their hands. And at the same time, we want them to look at certain things. We are not just, I try to make a few notes as you were speaking, and I got lost trying to do it. As an example, we don't look at this pool we're trying to develop to take any of the premium dollars presently being paid into private health insurance, commercial health insurance, or self-insureds. We are not interested in that. That is not what the bill says. It says contributions, I believe. It doesn't say premiums. So I've misread it. I'll look back at it again. situations like the cost of living language is, it's to the greatest degree possible. It's not absolutely locked to that. Now, we've got to bring health care costs down. We all know that. But at the same time, we can't do it by limiting access or not paying providers what they need to be paid, or we won't have any access at all. And you're absolutely right in that, too. So what I hear from you is your bottom line, and I appreciate your bottom line, is make sure that if you're going to do this, you do it carefully, you do it thoughtfully, and you fund it properly so it can get done. And that is what I heard from you the most tonight. I think that's right on target. And I would offer that we've got about a year and a half before we're back in session. I'm hoping that this group can do what we're asking to do. And frankly, if they can't get it done that fast because it's just too complex, I want to hear that too. But it has to have proper funding. We'd hopefully get into the structure that can get this program started. I believe that if this were to be put in place, this bill passes, we start a Herculean task, as you called it, a Herculean task to start changing how we deal with and how we deliver health care. And I don't know of any other state in the union doing this. I don't know of any other state doing it. A lot of them are pouring more money in. A lot of them are trying to put exchanges together. This is the only one I know of that says we've got to control costs and change how we deliver health care. That is a huge task.
Chairman, if I've been misinterpreted, I most certainly apologize. I know that you and your co-chair have worked exceedingly hard on this. I, on occasion, have worked on it once or twice in my career and through this process as well. It is very serious business, and I know you take it very seriously. The citizens of the state are in fact looking to all of us to try to put together a reasonable and fair process that benefits us all. And there are a variety of reasons why it will benefit the economy and most certainly the health and health care of our citizens. I appreciate it.
Does the committee have just one or two more questions? Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I am sensing that we actually have a mystery testifier. Let's see. Jane Ellen Wydance, is she in attendance tonight? Oh, look at that. And I'm sensing that she is going to take 2 minutes.
Yeah, you have to have a lot of skills as a chair.
Chairman Westland, you know that I speak faster than most human beings, and I will do my best to stay to a two-minute time period. For the record, my name is Jane Ellen Wydance. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Thank you for allowing me to testify at the last minute tonight. Oregon's hospitals support comprehensive health care reform. We came together as an association, came up with principles that mirror many of the principles you came up with, and Andy Davidson, our CEO and President, spoke about those at his previous testimony. Tonight I really want to talk about the dash fives and the very quick summary read that I have made of dash sixes, which was quick, so I apologize if I missed something. We appreciate the changes made from the four to the dash fours to the dash fives that included those with healthcare expertise on both the board and the subcommittees, and that I saw that continues in the dash sixes. We think that is a critical aspect of having people who understand healthcare systems, healthcare issues, included on those committees and boards. We are still unclear regarding the intent of the phrase designing a system for regional health delivery, and not sure what the intent of the committee and the members are regarding that issue, and we hope that there will be further clarification as we move through this process. We've expressed and we will continue to express that we are concerned about the time and the magnitude of the work that you're asking this board and all these subcommittees to do, and we're not sure if the time is sufficient for them to actually get the work done. And you may want to look at other states' healthcare reform efforts to see what they've done and how long it actually took them from the time that they initiated an official board and commission to when they instituted their new policies. We appreciate your acknowledgement of the problems associated with excluding coverage for pre-existing conditions, both for the individuals and for providers. We'll assess how the dash sixes address that issue and provide some feedback to you on that. And we are still concerned about a vague definition regarding federal contributions that are being pulled into this fund. Our concern there is that we don't have a problem with the Medicaid Title 18, 19 money and the Title 21 money being included, but we are concerned that there are often grants that are specifically dedicated to hospitals and other healthcare systems to implement research or to prepare for disasters and to be trauma centers in our states, and we really think that we need to continue to work on modifying that language that excludes those targeted, dedicated sources of funding that aren't directly related to access and providing coverage for individuals. So again, thank you for allowing me to testify. I told you I'd be short. We appreciate all the hard work that all of you have done, and especially the two co-chairs of this committee, and we are concerned that the continued fluid nature of all the dashes makes it difficult to actually tell you for sure where we stand. We will continue to work with you to make this as best as possible for Oregon. Thank you.
The committee have very few questions. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 329. And I'm going to pass the gavel to my co-chair.
Mr. Co-chair, I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 329 and ask legislative counsel to come forward and walk us through the bill.
The dash sixes.
The dash sixes to this bill. I know today that without thinking about it, I put my favorite tie on. My tie is the Looney Tunes tie. And I'm not sure that tells us anything at all except that I've gone over the edge again.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Lori Freeman. I'm with the Office of Legislative Counsel. And I'm going to just try to zip through the dash six amendments. First,
could you get just a little closer to the mic? You don't have to bend over. Just
okay. Is that better? No? Yes. I'll just speak in my booming voice.
What? What do you mean you want another amendment?
Now, don't break the mic.
Good job. Good job.
All right. All right. Oh, there we go. Pages 1 through 3 and the top of 4 are is the preamble, and that's unchanged from previous drafts. Section 1, unchanged, names it the Healthy Oregon Act. Section 2 is the definition section, and what we've done there is we moved safety net providers back down instead of having core safety net providers, and then we've just sort of tweaked with the definition of safety net providers to be a little more detailed about who those safety net providers are. Oh, I went too far.
And we hope that reflects the definition that the interim work group worked so hard on and it came up with. That was the purpose behind that amendment. So we're trying to honor that process as well as be comprehensive in our definition.
Yes, we tried to incorporate as much of the definitions that they came up with into this one as possible without getting it too long. But jumping back up to line 14, the defined set of essential health services. Previously, we had just referred to the prioritized list created by the Health Services Commission. And this change says it can either be that prioritized list or if there's an alternative methodology that's come up with by the subcommittees and presented to the Legislative Assembly, then you can use that one instead for defined set of essential health services. And on page 5, section 3 are the principles, and those are the same. Section 4 are the goals, and those two are the same. Oops. With one exception. On page 7, line 23, we added the phrase "to the greatest extent possible" with respect to trying to keep inflationary costs down. Section 5 is the Oregon Health Trust Board, and that is unchanged. Section 6 is the term of office of the board members, and I just want to note that this is set up that they will all expire on January 1, 2010, and then you get a whole new board, so it creates a transitional board.
Laura, there's nothing in that that, excuse me, Mr. Chair, there's nothing in that that precludes anyone from being continued on the board, though.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The same members could be reappointed. And Section 7, again, is the same. That's the governor appointing an interim executive director. And then Section 8, the trust board, when it's pulled together and confirmed, it appoints its executive director, which, again, could be the same person. Section 9 is the standard exclusions for semi-independent public agencies. Section 10 is the fund. No changes there. Section 11 the dash 5 amendments, I believe, I'm starting to lose track too, created this new committee that's going to look at federal law requirements. And so this section in one, subsection 1, we just did a little tweaking with the language to try to make it more clear what the charge of this federal committee will be. And then in subsection 2 on page 11. Yes.
And I'm sorry about this. Does this then look at the waiver piece? Is that what this committee will do?
The committee, Mr. Chairs, Senator Moss Anderson, this it could be a waiver. It could be whatever they think is necessary to get around these federal policies. But I think the intent is to do a thorough examination of the policies, figure out where the barriers are to, you know, rolling out this universal access plan, and then coming up with recommendations about how to deal with the federal restrictions. You also have a separate subcommittee that is looking at waivers specifically.
That's where I was getting confused, yeah.
Senator Mons Anderson?
So there was another subcommittee. I'm getting them confused. One to deal with the federal policy issues, but that we have another committee for the federal for the waivers. No.
No, there's not a...
Just one committee.
There's only one committee. There's not one for waivers specifically.
Yeah.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what we're intending to do in Section 11 as it results... Or as it is specifically referenced to Medicaid, is certainly ask for waivers. That needs to be done under several circumstances, not the least of which is trying to raise the poverty level and trying to do away with categorical eligibles. That's a very legitimate waiver request. With regard to, and I think Mr. Gallant properly pointed this out, with regard to federal tax code policies, EMTALA, and certainly Medicare, those would be legislative changes, required congressional changes, and so I want to make that distinction and just make sure everyone in the audience is clear on that, and I think that was a good catch, Mr. Gallant. And we addressed it three-fourths of the way. We just left out the waiver requirement for Medicaid.
Yes. In subsection 2, which begins on line 21 on page 11, this is just the introductory explanation about the charge to the board of developing a comprehensive plan, and we've added here language in section and lines 24 to 27 explaining that these various committees and offices will be staffing staffing the board, staffing the subcommittees. And that's the Oregon Health Policy Commission, Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research, Health Services Commission, and Medicaid Advisory Committee.
And I might add that we realize that these agencies or units cannot do the work we want them to do without additional financing. This is beyond, above and beyond what they have to do already. We understand that, and more resources will be coming forward to help them with their work.
And then there weren't any other changes to Section 11 until you get to page 16 and lines 4 and 5. We just tweaked the language there to make it clear that the enrollees have to demonstrate their Oregon residency to qualify. And we've added the new subsection, small Roman numeral 3, which allows a provider to enroll someone if they present and they're not enrolled in a health plan, would allow the provider to a process for enrolling the person and having coverage as of that date. Line 9, we've added pre-existing condition limitations as something a subcommittee may consider for the accountable health plans. Lines 24 through 28, this new subsection, which actually begins on 19, the idea was that these offices and commissions and committees would begin to work right off the bat, compiling data, doing the research, whatever they need, so that when the subcommittees are convened, they can get right to work. And this makes it clear on line 24 that no later than December 1st, 2007, these offices, committees, and commissions will be presenting their reports and recommendations to the subcommittees. On page 17, line 15, this subsection 4 was the membership of the subcommittees. In the last amendment, the dash 5, we had a limitation on membership from people who have financial interest in the healthcare industry or the insurance industry, and that was removed.
Lori, to put a finer edge on that, on the trust board, we have a limit on that. The majority cannot be those who are deriving their primary income from health care. This is the reverse of that. There's a good reason for that. These subcommittees are going to have to be made up of experts in the field, people from hospitals, physicians, insurers, nurses. We want the experts in these subcommittees to bring forward to the board the knowledge that we're going to need to make this system move and change. We cannot do this without that expertise. The people sitting in this room, many of the people sitting in this room are the people we need on these subcommittees. These are the real drivers of this new change to the system. So we'll make it very clear that those subcommittees are going to be made up of providers and others in the healthcare system. Lori, please continue.
Well, I think it's also, if I may, Mr. Chair, I think it's also important. You put too fine a point on that, and you can get into, you know, a protracted and unnecessary debate on, say, pick a healthcare advocate whose primary source of income comes from advocating healthcare issues. Would that exclude them? Well, we want people that know what they're doing on these subcommittees. That's the bottom line.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs. The next change in Section 11 appears on page 18. It's in subsection 9, which begins on line 5. And in the previous drafts, we had the board making an interim report to a legislative committee on just some specific issues with respect to things like medical malpractice and so forth. And this was restructured so that instead the board is coming before a legislative committee and actually doing a full progress report on where they're going and what they're coming up with and how far along they are on these three items, which are A, B, and C: ensure universal access to health care, B, contain health care costs, and address issues regarding quality of health care services. Section 12 and 13 are unchanged. That's the process for finalizing the comprehensive plan. Section 14 is the individual mandate. We just added some language at the beginning of at line 6 on page 19 to make it clear that this is, again, part of the planning for the Accountable Health Plan public-private partnership, but that they want that a clear legislative directive that the recommendation contain an individual mandate. And then beginning on line 19, subsection 2 just makes it clear that people who are in these health insurance plans may not be required to participate in the program. And those are the only changes from the dash 5. I can go back over the old sections if you'd like.
I don't think it's going to be necessary, Lori, but I'll ask you to stay at the podium just for a moment in case there are questions from the committee on this bill. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about whether you've discussed the bill with legislative fiscal and where we're at as far as any concerns on fiscal, the cost or anything like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I have not spoken to legislative fiscal.
Representative Richardson, obviously we've had some conversations. We believe at this point that we've got the physicalness covered by bringing Uper over and making the board a non-paid board. We've dramatically dropped that cost. At the same time, going back to Mr. Gallant's comments, this is a huge effort, and it's going to take a lot of work, and frankly has to be done carefully and thoughtfully. And a lot of us are going to be continuing to work on this as it goes forward. And this is a roadmap, but not a perfect roadmap, because there is no perfect roadmap. But we have to make a start at this, and it has to be a good start. I believe we're there, but the proof was in the pudding. We'll wait and see. Okay? This bill's ready to move, I believe, but I want to hear any more questions from the panel first. And I realize the Nash 6s are fairly new to you in many ways, but they've got into a lot of work to get them to the point we are at now, and I think we've satisfied most of the people who we've been dealing with as far as advocates and the general public. Senator Mons Anderson.
Thank you, Chair. I was wondering if you've gotten input from Uper and the governor on the concepts here.
Senator Mons Anderson, the answer is yes. And it was positive. It was positive. There, I believe the only question that remains unanswered is whether or not Uper comes directly into the control of the board or contracts with the board. The language of the bill right now says they contract up to the time that the board takes place. The board's actually comes into being, at which time it's transferred over. We can discuss that later further with the governor's staff and with the governor himself. At this point, they are in agreement with the bill. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I think I know the answer to this, but I'll ask it anyway. On page 19, you just, line 19, Oregon residents who are enrolled and so on, may not be required. Now, that will be determined by the board. Someone's going to have to take a look at the programs that they're enrolled in and make a determination as to whether or not they will be required to be in the plan. Is that the idea?
The plan here is to make, I believe this, and what we meant this to say, is to make it very clear that if you already have commercial insurance, if you already are self-insured, either publicly or privately, if you're under a Taft-Hartley trust getting your insurance, you are not going to go into the pool.
Well, it says may not.
That's may not be required
well,
to go into the pool.
Well, but there's wiggle room there.
Well,
someone is going to determine whether or not you have to go into the pool, and so that word "may" is what I'm asking.
Oh, Mr. Chair, we had that same problem in our committee, and legislative council said that when you have a negative, the "shall" turns to "may." We had that same question on another bill.
I believe it's proscribed them from going into the pool, the language we have, and we were trying to be as clear as possible on that in saying so.
You know, as long as we're all talking, why don't we let the person that drafted it and share her educated, knowledgeable opinion?
I directed my question to that person.
I know you did, Senator Morissette. I'm just trying to, you know, I'm trying to cut Lori off and Senator Bates off, you know, politely.
Let's see. Tweety said that he thinks that's what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Lori, you want to answer that question?
Senator Morissette. May not be required means that they may participate if they wish, mm-hmm. but the board may not require them to participate.
Meaning they shall not require them.
They shall not require them to participate.
Okay.
Under our form and style manual, we say may not.
Okay.
Further questions?
What that means is they can't force them in.
Is that a fair, you know, kind of Central Oregon
That's
way
question.
To say that?
You're supposed to be helping here. May not and what we also got in committee was may not and shall not really are the same phrase legally as long as they're used together, may not and shall not. But may or shall used by themselves are significantly different. You may or you shall, and we have that in the committee. We were also dealing with a different bill, but something similar with the same kind of questions being asked.
Mr. Co-Chair, yes, there's been an effort in legislative council to try to make it clear in the Oregon statutes by saying may not when we mean they're prohibited from, instead of using shall not. And only using shall when it's an affirmative duty to do something, so an agency shall do something or an individual shall do something.
Question?
Representative Richardson.
Kind of continuing on that same issue on page 19, 14, subparagraph 2, I don't remember the gentleman's name, but we had testimony from a man who was involved in a medical ministry. And he left some material, and it mm-hmm. was very impressive to what they were doing, but I don't think it qualified as a commercial or any kind of insurance program, but it did provide health benefits and it was meeting needs of 1,000 Oregonians. I'm wondering if that organization would be swallowed up and prevented from doing what they're doing because this refers to commercial insurance programs and self-insurance programs, or would self-insurance include a medical ministry?
I'm going to turn this one back to you because I got chastised last time for answering questions. I'm obviously a qualified answer.
Thank you, Mr.
Co-Chair.
Lori?
Mr. Co-Chair's Representative Richardson, the way this is structured, that if you're not a beneficiary of a health benefit plan and you're not enrolled in a publicly funded medical assistance program or one of the exceptions in subsection 2, you have to participate. There's that individual mandate. As I read this, the people in the ministry's program would not be considered to be a beneficiary of a health benefit plan. So there would have to be an amendment to this made to make it clear if you wanted them to be excluded.
I spoke. Do you remember the individual's name? Well, I'm worse than you because I just spoke to him today, and he's very polite. And, they wanted to proffer an amendment, and I said, this is like five to five, and I don't know if that has been drafted. I suppose that's not my privilege to ask, but the." The issue I have, and I explained this to him, the issue I have, while that is, I think, it's a symptom of the problem, is that folks can't afford insurance that is currently commercially offered, and so they have really, you know, used entrepreneurial spirit and evolved into a system that is currently working well. My issue is this. If they wanted to form a group and buy an appropriate amount of catastrophic insurance for a defined set of individuals, I'd be very happy with that. But the issue is what happens when they get the 6 preemies and the 4 quadruple heart bypasses and they don't have insurance? Where does that cost then go? It is cost shifted to other payers. Now, I indicated the individual, and like I say, I mean, this is literally right before committee. I said I'd be happy to meet with you when I had, you know, the ability to have a more thoughtful conversation, leisurely conversation, and he availed himself of that opportunity. So we are going to continue to talk. But I just stated that concern to him, and I state that on the record. If there's a way to address that, I think that's an appropriate conversation.
Thank you. Just a comment on that, Mr. Chair. I certainly think that it would be appropriate that we not decide what is best for a group that have been doing something for 10 years and there's 1,000 Oregonians that have met their needs, and we make the decision, well, if we can come up with a, for instance, where it may not continue to meet their needs and therefore we're going to force them to stop doing what they're choosing to do, which is meeting their medical care needs in a way that they want to, and enforce upon them our program or a government-enforced insurance plan. And so I just would hope that we keep things flexible, since we often don't solve problems but have unintended consequences that end up harming people. And here's a group that are saying, we don't need your help, we're providing medical care, we've been doing it for 10 years, and we'd like to have that ongoing flexibility. So I just mentioned that.
And Representative Richardson, I would reply to you that you're absolutely right in many ways here. I agree. We don't want to penalize a group that is faith-based or any other group that is trying to do the right thing. I would offer that they could become an accountable health plan. Yes. They might want to set up a situation in which they have the same system they have right now and ask their members to tithe a certain amount to buy stopgap insurance, and so they would not be have any opportunity to cost shift or any time that they would have to cost shift, and continue the same program they're in now, one that they've chosen for themselves that fits their needs, both from the point of view of health, point of view of their personal moral issues. And I see nothing wrong with them doing that, and I would hope this program would be such that they could do it. As long as they can show that they're not going to cost shift and they can buy that kind of insurance for backup for those catastrophic illnesses, because clearly this is a group that has come together and says we're going to take care of each other and we're going to do it in a way that we think works and we can prove works. The only issue we have with them is that they have run into that terrible catastrophic illness that no one can predict, at which point they'd be forced to go to cost shift other groups. I think there's a way for them to do what they're doing right now and inside this program to continue it. So I value those groups coming forward and offering to take part in this program.
I think it's good that we have it on the record that they have been considered.
I would agree.
Okay.
There are more.
Thank you. When I met with the gentleman who was here, I asked that question, and he assured me that they had the mechanism to take care of it. I didn't pursue the questioning, though. seems to me this might even be considered a self-insured group if everybody contributes. But I guess in listening to Senator Bates about the catastrophic care, I guess to have the guarantee that would happen, that might be the solution. But I think it's a great program, and I think we ought to make it fit if we possibly can. I think it's a great program.
My comment is that, and I wish I could remember the gentleman's name.
We're all having a different
we're all having
with names.
And, is
I remember yours.
Thanks.
Yeah. You're looking real good tonight, Tom.
Yeah. And so is Bill.
Yeah. is that their issue is that they are doing some things because of the regulations that we have in the state and the federal government that if they do certain, you know, put money in certain piles, that it is now termed insurance. And so we have created this regulatory system that prevents them from fitting into a normal structure that would be sustainable. And so I think under Section 11, page 10 and 11 of this dash 6, that we have an opportunity to address that body of regulation or law that can be a change so that these people can function as they have, maybe with some modifications, but function as they have in a new concept and a new structure. And so I think it's very important that we keep an open mind to how this is worded so that we don't close these people out and allow them to continue dealing with the way. Because quite frankly, the term on page 19, and it doesn't say it as much, but the individual mandate, I mean, that's I mean, you're going to hit the political brick wall when that term is used. And so I think as much flexibility in how we define what an individual mandate means is going to be critical to the viability of this and the acceptance of this bill or this program by the people in the state.
I would agree and tell you that we want nothing in this bill to make people think that we want them to stop being innovative, that we have a diversity of ways of dealing with this issue for different groups, that anything is going to be other than one-size-fits-all kind of thinking. There will be different communities stepping up in different ways. There will be different groups stepping up in different ways. And this is designed to allow them to do so. Further questions? Hearing none, I would accept a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 6 amendments dated April 25th, 2007, into Senate Bill 329.
I hear a motion to move the dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 329. Any discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. I will take a second motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 329 as amended by the dash sixes to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference with a do pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Those of the opinion that Senate Bill 329 as amended be moved to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by a prior reference with a do pass recommendation answer aye, as your name is called. Those opposed answered no. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Cruz? Excuse. Senator Monica Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Vice Chair Winters? Excuse. Co-Chair Westland?
Aye.
Aye. I'd like to pause just for a moment.
Declare it passed.
And before I declare it passed, I want to pause just for a moment and thank everyone here for what we are now accomplishing. This is a step towards a very big change potentially for Oregon. The motion is passed. We are not adjourned.
Wow.
Thank you.
Good job.